So in previous weeks, we had the opportunity to explore questions related to the halachot of abortion. That was really the two classes that we spent on the topic of abortion. And what we're going to do now is going to tie that together with the question of a fetal reduction. So what does that mean? So in other words, until now we had discussed the question of, let's say, God forbid, there is either a potential a genetic anomaly and terrible illness that we already can test for and know will befall this fetus once it is born. Or what if these are extenuating circumstances, God forbid a case of rape, of incest, and so on and so forth. What are the scenarios in which halakha will justify abortion? And what we did was we laid out a whole range of different opinions about that. We don't really need all that information for the purposes of our discussion today, but just very briefly, what we sketched out is that there's a range of different opinions, basically, that the authorities take, everything ranging from, essentially, it is almost the equivalent of murder, to everything from there all the way to it's just a rabbinic prohibition, in general, abortion. In other words, like a full-term viable fetus, and I go ahead and abort without any halachic justification. What's the level of prohibition? So is it basically murder? Although we know that at least a Jew is not put to death for it, but other than that, it's effectively murder. And everything from there to say, no, the fact that there's no death penalty for Jews shows that it's only a rabbinic prohibition. And
when you said full-term viable, you don't mean a full-term abortion, you mean early.
No, I'm talking about like the worst-case scenario, the most severe scenario of abortion. How stringent is that? What kind of prohibition is that? Is that basically the equivalent, nearly the equivalent of killing a full-fledged living human being? Or, shalom, or is that... is that merely a rabbinic prohibition? And then we said that, there are other cutoff points as well. Before 40 days, the Gemara says essentially it's a mere water. Maybe 3 months is the cutoff point. Maybe 6 months is the cutoff point. I'm sorry, there's no fruit left. And I don't know if everyone saw the email, but I have to stop at about 11:15 today. So just everyone knows my schedule. So we got underway. So we've been talking about these questions of abortion, and we said depending on the level of severity of the prohibition of abortion in general, as well as the stage of development of the fetus, that will have all sorts of ramifications on the practical questions of abortion. If it's merely a rabbinic prohibition, then there's much more room for leniency, not only in a case where the mother's life is actually threatened, where we know we definitely can abort according to halacha, but even in a case of psychological distress and so on and so forth, whereas the more stringent that I see the prohibition of abortion, the closer that it is to murder, the more stringent we're going to have to be, and we would only be inclined to permit it only in cases of pikuach nefesh, where there's a danger to life. Although we granted that that could be either physical danger to life or maybe even psychological endangerment, etc. And we said that there's a related but distinct question of fetal reduction. So what's fetal reduction? So this is something that comes up quite commonly nowadays. We have, in these cases of fertility that we've been talking about, and here's where abortion and the fertility discussions intersect, in the case of fertility, it's very common, we pointed out, that even today, with all of our advances, IVF is typically successful at a 15 to 20% rate. And so it's extremely common for A, woman to have multiple embryos frozen, and B, for the adopter to implant multiple embryos into the woman in order to ensure the success of this procedure. At the same time, that runs the risk of an increase in the number of embryos that are successfully fertilized and then become fetuses. Well, you might say that sounds wonderful. After all, you have a woman who's been struggling to have children, and maybe she can have twins, right? Or triplets, or become octomom, right? Well, right, we know from such things. And we know that the larger the number of fetuses, of course, that the mother's carrying, the higher the incidence of danger. Even twins are considered to be not necessarily dangerous, but my impression is that, from the people I've spoken to, that twins, in a typical case, all things being equal, generally is relatively safe, but as soon as you add in any complicating factors in terms of the history of birth for the mother or anything with the fetuses that we've identified, any anomalies or the age of the woman, very often IVF, you'll have a woman who's decided to go ahead with this because woman's older, or people just in general getting married older and older in Western civilization society today. So you tend to have an older woman, so even if she's carrying twins, there can already be complications, but there can be additional complications as well, never mind triplets, and never mind even more than that. And so the question becomes, halachically speaking, how do we handle this? How does the secular world handle it? And what's the halachic angle? And I have to say, in starting to look at these sources, the halachic analysis is really not 100% clear. And it's a relatively new question, as many of these are, but since IVF became popular, so we're talking about the last 20 years, effectively, this becomes a question. And so there are very different sort of ways of approaching the question, which are generally related to the questions that we've been talking about, but they are different. But there are sort of different vantage points and ways that you can come into it. Before we look at the halachic sources, just a little bit about how does secular ethics deal with this question. So there are lots of more current articles, but I figured, hey, if there's a Philly connection, why not use it? So Dr. Danny Eisenberg, who happens to live in the community, is big on medical ethics, and now he can listen to the recording, because I know he's been checking in on me, listening to my shiurim from time to time, make sure that I'm getting my medical ethics correct. So far, I think I've passed the test, but I don't know how many he's listened to. And I figured, hey, I found a short piece of his online that summarized some of the issues. So I took an excerpt from there. This is already back in, based on an article from 2004. So this is already ancient medical history. You may as well go back to Galen or Hippocrates once you're, you know, in our world. You know, 2004 is a few medical generations back already. But here the basic issues are similar. So he writes, a woman pregnant, right? So he cites from an article from the AP, Grand Rapids, Michigan, a woman pregnant with sextuplets. This is back when sextuplets was, you know, a really exciting kind of case, right? Octomom, I think, was after this. Am I right? I think it was a couple years after this. Has given birth to 5 remaining babies more than a week after delivering the first, a hospital official said yesterday, Saturday. That was interesting to me already. I don't know the incidence of that. But this is no Yaakov and Esav over here, right? This is really interesting. This is not one hanging on the heel of the other.
Also, the risk of infection from ruptured membranes.
You would think, right? Yeah. This is not something that's... I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what the scenario was. And this is something that doctors would want to avoid.
But if they were premature, yeah, they would probably
carry the rest in utero as long as possible. So I assume it was quite premature. And I should have mentioned that earlier, by the way. That point also needs to be added, right? Once you have multiples, you're almost certainly going to have early births, right? Which adds, right? And the more you have, the more likely it is to be early. So you have all the preterm related issues as well. Okay, the birth in January of a set of live sextuplets in Grand Rapids, Michigan, writes Dr. Eisenberg, it is timely to examine the Jewish view of a common complication of infertility treatment, multiple gestations. Such excitement has not occurred since 1998. The first known set of live septuplets occurred in the United States. Okay, so that was 7. Still not quite octomom, but you get the idea. Such multiple gestations are rare, with, at that time, 6,742 sets of triplets, 506 sets of quadruplets and 77 sets of quintuplets or higher order pregnancies in 2000. I'm not sure if it's gone up or down. The incidence of IVF has skyrocketed, but there is even greater caution in the medical community about going ahead with these things. So I'm not sure where the numbers stand today.
Go ahead. they're not expecting statistically,
yeah.
You know, maybe 2 will survive.
Right, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Zero, they're not, it's
and far. Right, now there are laws that have been passed, there's legislation since these that limit the number that, you know, I don't know exactly what the law is, I think it's a state law, I don't think it's a federal law, but there had definitely been, where'd it go? No, that's not, is it under here?
No.
Oh, it's here, sorry. Yep, that's like glasses right in front of your eyes. Yeah, so I'm not sure, right. So there's definitely legislation been put in place, you know, minimizing the number, I believe, by state, but at that time there were no legal limits. So he continues, normally a woman produces one mature egg per month. The common infertility treatment requires a woman to take ovulatory drugs, which cause her to hyperovulate, producing many mature eggs at one time. These multiple eggs may be allowed to proceed naturally through the fallopian tubes to be fertilized, or they may be extracted and used for in vitro fertilization, which is what we're talking about. In the former case, multiple pregnancy may occur without any other intervention. In the latter case, the decision must be made as to how many eggs to implant following the in vitro fertilization procedure. Because of the high cost of treatment and relatively low success rate of such treatments, which is improving every day, but again, I think it's still like not more than 20% as far as I know, a decision is sometimes made to implant several fertilized eggs. The expectation is that only a few of the eggs will be born, result in a viable pregnancy, and that hopefully at least one or two children will be born. Therefore, an undesired result of infertility treatment is the situation of a woman pregnant with up to 7 fetuses. For women who have multiple gestations are at increased risk for many types of complications, including gestational diabetes, premature delivery, eclampsia, severe high blood pressure, and seizures and birth defects. They're usually forced to spend much of the pregnancy in bed to minimize the risk of complications. The complication rate for twins is higher than for singletons, and the rate of complications only increases as the number of fetuses in the womb increases, with a steep jump with quadruplets. Not only does the danger to the mother increase with more fetuses, but also the risk of miscarriage and the lives of all the fetuses increases. As a result, many physicians recommend selectively aborting some of the fetuses to reduce the pregnancy to twins or triplets at most. Now, my impression is that in the secular medical community, twins generally are... The more common thing with twins is not to select, and even there, though, it's not rare or unheard of to select among the twins. Now, that may depend medically. One second, this is my impression, that especially in terms of where there are medical complications or medical history, that increases the likelihood. In cases of triplets, that's where it's more fuzzy. And you will find, I think that there's been an increase, but I'm not certain, but certainly you find it more common. And triplets is where halachic authorities will be much more hesitant to permit. That's sort of the nafkamina case, as it were, the practical case where the rubber hits the road. And four or more, generally speaking, as we'll see, halachic authorities definitely encourage it. But the question still remains, A, what's the halachic basis for this? Practically, how do we decide whether or not to go ahead with fetal reduction? And how do you decide if you're going to do it? Which one?
I don't understand.
Oh.
Did you say it's more common for twins than for triplets?
No.
The other way around.
Twins, we're finding that it happens, especially with their medical complications. Triplets, it's not at all uncommon. It's quite common to reduce. Many halakhic authorities are very uncomfortable with that, depending on the scenario. Again, it depends on all the other situational considerations. And quadruplets or more are considered to be potentially life-threatening, even to the mother and certainly to the fetuses. We don't think it's very likely at all that they'll even, all four will survive, never mind thrive. So that's where it's a simpler question, halakhic. Okay, so, and again, the question is sort of what's the halachic analysis of this? If you take a look at source 2, just to recognize that the general distinction between abortion and fetal reduction, secular medical associations also recognize the distinction that they're not exactly the same. So this is from the Committee on Ethics of the American College of ONG, as they say, right? OBGYN, of obstetrics and gynecology, insofar as the intention of selective termination is different from that of other multi-fetal reductions, right, its ethical rationale is importantly distinctive. That is, the intention in selective termination, in other words, if you have multiples and you're just going to choose among them, is to avoid having a child with a known medical problem. Whereas the intention of multifetal reduction is to prevent problems that are secondary to multifetal gestation and premature birth. In other words, sometimes you have even multiple fetuses and you choose to abort because you already know that there is a genetic disorder or what have you. That's different from a more generic decision, a blanket decision, to say there are multiples we're going to reduce. Right? Notice the name, the terminology. Right? Fetal reduction.
Yes.
it's like a pre-owned car. Right? It's a little bit euphemistic, perhaps. It's just interesting. Fetal reduction. Okay. What do they say now? We are, conciliar separation? What do they call divorce? There have been divorces,
oh,
maybe.
There's conciliatory?
Something like that. Anyhow, okay. So how do Postgim approach this issue, and what are the potential challenges? And one of the major issues that comes up is the question of, A, how do we analyze this situation, halachically? In other words, how do we view the basis for allowing us to reduce or to abort one or more fetuses, right? And B, what is the halachic analysis here in terms of whether or not we can choose between them? So I want to go back to something we discussed last time, and I want to incorporate or introduce something new. So if we remember last time, I don't think I gave you the source explicitly here, but I want to invoke it again. So if you remember, we had a discussion in context of abortion last week for those who were able to be here, but just to review for everyone as follows. There's a Mishnah in Ahalot that teaches as follows. Mishnah says that if you have a case of a fetus that endangers the life of the mother, what's the halakha? Right, are we permitted to abort?
Yes.
Right, we are permitted to abort. However, once the baby emerges from the mother, what's the halakha? Or once the head comes out, or we said the majority of the baby, if let's say it comes out backwards somehow, like in a C-section or something like that, right? What's the halakha? Once the child is considered to be halakhically born into this world, at that point, what do we say? Right?
Say you,
right? Right? Because now it's a viable, it's already a full-fledged human life, as it were, and therefore we don't intercede. Okay? So, in other words, we allow nature to take its course, basically. So that if the child is now endangering the life of the mother, we say, hands off. Right? Unless they're both going to die. But assuming that's the case, we can no longer halakhically justify actively killing the baby in order to save the life of the mother. And we said, this is very important for the halakhot of abortion. Why? Because what does it seem at first glance to imply? That what?
The child's inside is still secondary.
Right, that somehow it's not a full-fledged life. Right, and that might imply that abortion is maybe not murder because it might not be a full-fledged halachic life while it's in the womb, and that might be the basis for that distinction, except that the Rambam comes along and gives a very different logic for this. Okay, so again, either review or just to bring everyone up to speed, the Rambam says that no, it doesn't. He seems to imply that really it's a full life even as a fetus. But what he does is he says that while the fetus is inside the mother, he says that the reason we're allowed to kill the fetus and save the mother's life is because the fetus is considered to be what we call a rodef, a pursuer, right? Someone who is basically seeking to kill the mother. Seeking to kill the mother, right? Freudian explanation of, right? Like it's, you know, intentional. As was pointed out last time, this would seem to imply that for the Rambam at least, that Rodef even applies to an unintentional potential killer. And that just as the halakha is, if someone is running after me, or even if I see someone running after someone else to kill him or her, then I am permitted to do what? If I need to in order to stop the person, to kill them in order to stop them from committing murder, so too the fetus is viewed in the same way. Now, what's strange about the Rambam is that, well, then, hold on one second. What changes once it comes into this world? That's what we started to discuss last time. In other words, just because it was born doesn't necessarily mean that all of a sudden, oh, now it's not a pursuer. Really?
Right.
Why was it less of a pursuer inside the mother's womb than it is now? It's still endangering the life of the mother.
But you're saying it's only, you're only considering endangering the life of the mother if it's partially born. So it's a life. Because once it's out, there's no danger, right? So
there could be danger. No. The Rambam says, even if there is still danger to the life of the mother, for example, the head came out, right? So halachically, it's considered to be born.
Partially.
But the rest of the body poses a medical risk to the mother.
Right.
So
okay.
And the Rambam says, once that happens, it's considered at this point, you're not allowed to kill the baby because it's considered to be born. Interesting. Okay, so that's just a little bit of background. So the way that many suggested is that probably what's driving him to say it, at least, is that he thinks that the fetus is a real life, is a full-fledged life, so we suggested last time. And so he had to come onto something. How do you explain that discrepancy that we're going to see a little bit more about, but it remains a little bit difficult, and there are a lot of theories that have been offered, but it does seem a little bit strange. Now, how might that scenario be relevant? Is it relevant to fetal reduction? What's the similarity and what's the difference in terms of frame? Is that a precedent for our case? Because there is no direct precedent in the Gemara or even the Rishonim for fetal reduction. And the reason for that is, right? Right? Okay. So. Go ahead. Okay.
Well,
hold on, but we compared, right?
Because it's all differentiated.
Right, you might be right, but what the Rambam differentiated?
Between inside and outside.
Good. So what?
Other.
Right. So what about these different fetuses? Are the fetuses threatening the mother?
They could be.
If the fetuses, therefore, are threatening the mother, what would seem to be clear? So let's say we find out Mazel Tov or complicated Mazel Tov, Bishaot Tovot Me'od, okay? All right, so we've got Akt Omam in waiting over here. All right, so is the mother endangered in such a scenario?
Yes.
Clearly, okay? So in that case, based on these laws, presumably we would think you can do an abortion, except there's only one complicated factor, which is what? You're going
to
kill all of them? No.
So
how many? And how do you choose? And that is complicated. So there is an ethical difficulty. It's easier to, if you have one, you just one. But if what's threatening the life of the mother is not all eight, but actually the number, but if we reduce to twins or even triplets, it's a totally maybe even quadruple. But let's say triplets, it's the doctor says this is dangerous maybe for the fetuses, but not for the mother, let's just say, right? It's not ideal, but she should be all right. How do we decide among them?
I don't know medically. Two things. First of all, it seems that a question and then a comment. Can we consider that any one of the fetuses are in fact a rotate for any of the other fetuses?
Very good, Emily. Excellent. That's the other point that the post can make. The first thing they consider is the extent to which they are a rodef of the mother. And then it should be permissible to abort, but we have to figure out this question of how do you ethically choose among them.
So
fine. But then, right, but then, Emily, you're right. The second stage is, even leaving aside the endangerment of the mother, they seem to endanger one another.
So could the doctors determine, depending on the position of one of them, which one is perhaps threatening another one?
More.
Possibly.
And in fact, that's part of how doctors determine how do they do it. So that's the first thing. The first thing they'll look at is the least viable, which might be the smallest, etc. Another consideration is which one is most accessible to the doctors, frankly.
Oh.
Which it's kind of...
Which
is the easiest one to abort with the least potential complications?
So the danger,
we're just talking about is like, oh, you just go ahead with an abortion. It can be safer than birth very often, but that too is a medical procedure, and the later it is, right, the more serious it is.
They just leave it in the hands of the surgeon. I mean, you can't do all the second guessing and ethical questioning.
What if you're a from surgeon? And you want to know?
Still, he just does it based. He's not going to.
He's
obviously in the heat of the moment. I don't think he's going to be able to figure out which one.
No, that's not true. That is not true.
But then why are we having our classes? Then why should we waste our time here?
Because you just stopped the recording now. Because you do have these considerations in terms of how you choose, and there are some practical considerations,
sure,
that push aside maybe halacha wouldn't enter into so much because it's just,
yeah,
it's what you can do.
Right.
But there's also other considerations where you would have a choice.
Yes, and
it's not
so
black and white.
You have not a choice to begin with.
Now you're right that in this scenario, it's most likely that the halachic calculus will probably be similar to the medical calculus, because in the end, the medical calculus is about saving lives. But it's tricky, because the medical calculus might be, you know what, we did genetic testing on these fetuses, and one of them has Downs.
Oh. Or to make it even more...
Okay, and very often that'll be the one they abort. And guess what? Wow, so that's I'm responding to your question, right? It's not so... Right?
Or to make it more frightening, what if there are gender preferences? And they say,
right.
Well, I want to pick that one, but not that one.
Okay.
Whoa.
Right.
Yeah,
okay, right? So go back to the pre-GD choosing your baby's gender discussion, right? This is a really scary kind
of
thing.
In the case of multiples, including like an argument, I don't know what the halakha is if there is Down syndrome, but that baby is less likely to survive. So, you know, on the viability issue, you might have more chance.
What, the Downs baby? I don't think that's true.
Not anymore.
I'm not sure. I mean, they've got a lot of lower life expectancy. They've got a lot of
barely. Well, that's a tricky thing also. I mean...
Obviously, it's tricky, but...
Let's say someone has a disease that, you know, they're likely to have a slightly shorter life expectancy, but it's not like KSAX. Again, like, where do you draw the line?
No, obviously, there's issues. You know?
Congenital anomalies are more... like, significant cardiac anomalies and such are more common in Downs babies.
Okay.
But again, you know, you should be able to determine that all in utero now, because the ultrasound techniques.
You can test for that also. In other words, just because
there's and you know, you can, and many of those are surgically correctable.
Mm-hmm.
Some are better than others.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying, in a case like this, where not everything is equal, you could make it.
100%.
And in the case of a religious observant surgeon,
yes.
Does the surgeon have to abide by the surgeons?
Or the patients?
Yeah.
These are major ethical conflicts that many doctors have a don't ask, don't tell halachic policy about, quite frankly. Let's be real about it. But I will. Well, so the question is, are you a solo practitioner? Do you have someone else? It gets complicated. I have been contacted by surgeons who are very sensitive to halachic matters and are extremely competent professionally, so far as I can tell. And I know someone who has a partner, and the policy is that if it's triplets, he just doesn't handle that fetal reduction. That's just how he handles it. He asked the Shiloh at some point and said, if there's no additional medical complication, all things being equal, it's very questionable. And so what he does is he just takes vacation. He said no, he doesn't. But he had a scenario in which we had to talk it out, because he had one partner and the partner was on vacation. It's not so simple, you know. Put it that way. I know you're in Honolulu. What if they're Jewish? But what? We're Catholic, right? Well, he knew to choose a secular partner from the get go. He was what? If it's a Catholic or if it's a secular? Yeah, it's complicated. It is, because abortion is... No, even a secular Gentile, it's not so simple what they're choosing to do. Right? Because we said last time that abortion might be even more severe for... Seems to be more severe, so...
I mean, these cases are very complicated, and it extends, you know, beyond this particular topic, because you have many situations now in medicine where...
Yeah.
You know, patient preference,
sure,
you know, with
absolutely.
Role of life support,
right.
Or not things, or, you know, that are medically accepted but are halakhically very problematic. And how do you handle it when you're the attending?
Yeah.
I can tell you these are very difficult issues.
Yeah, and we're still figuring this out, I can tell you. If my time at Einstein is any indication, there's a lot of confusion around out there on the Shabbos issues, on the everything. Is there Shabbos in the hospital? Well, there is Shabbos in the hospital.
I have to deal with
but, it. Right? Shabbos exists even in the hospital, but, you know, it's far from simple. It's as you all know. Okay, so with my eyes on the time, let me just share a couple of the pertinent sources. So we mentioned the question of, well, how do you choose? And we said, well, there are certain methods that we use. And there's a parallel Gemara I reproduce in both source 3 and 4. It's essentially the same. The Gemara talks about, this is in context of the Gemara of Yiharig Val Yavor. In other words, what are the cases in which this sin that I have been asked to perform is so severe that it's better for me to give up my life rather than go ahead with the sin? Of course, the classic big three are murder, idolatry, and illicit relations. The Gemara wants to know, wrote Seach Gufin Minalan, source 3, how do we know this halacha, that with regards to the murderer, I have to allow myself to be killed rather than to kill someone else, right? In other words, if someone puts a gun to my head and says, right, you're now working for the mafia, and we're not doing kneecaps anymore, right? We're just, we're eliminating someone. So the halacha is that one has to be willing to give up one's own life rather than commit murder. So the Gemara tells a story about someone who came in front of Rabba and said to him that there was a certain person, or this lord who was in charge of this place, who told me to go ahead and kill someone. And Rabba said, better for you to be killed than to go ahead and to listen to him. And what's his logic for this? Right? So if you look at the second to last line in the Aramaic or Hebrew in source 3, Mi Yemar Didama Didach Sumakfe, who says your blood is redder, Dima Dama Dahu Gav Dehu Gavra Sumakfe, maybe the blood of that other individual is more red, right? Which is in some places called the logic of my chazis, meaning what do you see? What do you see that makes one person's life more valuable than the next person's life? Who are we as human beings to play God and to choose one life over another? Right? And that raises the whole ethical question of how do you choose? And that's why there needs to be some sort of objective way of distinguishing among the fetuses. And I'm not going to go into the Rashi now, but Rashi kind of, he struggles with this. And Rashi says, you know, okay, wait a second. If it's really true that the two lives are equal, then why should I have to give up my life?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, fair is fair. Right? So why do I die rather than him?
And what happens if someone else is going to kill him anyway?
So we're going to come back, hold that thought. We're going to come to that in a moment. Okay? So Rashi says something fascinating. What I would have said is that there's a difference between passive and active. And this goes back to some of the questions that we discussed in triage. You know, there's a difference between my allowing something to happen versus my perpetrating it. We've seen that before. There's a difference between my allowing the trolley car to hurtle down the tracks and pulling the switch or, you know, pushing the fat man over the bridge, right? For those who were there. And recall, those are different kinds of things, active versus passive. Interestingly, Rashi doesn't go that way. Rashi says, well, it's actually better for me to avoid also violating the prohibition of murder. It's interesting, except there's a problem with that because someone's murdering someone anyway, right? Either someone's murdering me or I'm murdering someone else. It's a hard Rashi to understand. But you see that there's this notion. I'm just going to jump a little bit. I just wanted to point out and then I'll come back. If you go to sources 9 and 10, I believe we've seen this, and we're not going to have time to go inside, but I wanted to bring it to your attention. This paya goes to the point that you just made. And this is the case that we discussed in context of triage, of once upon a time, of the Gentiles who come to the town and demand that the townspeople give up one of the members of the town, right? And say, you know, give us some of you or we're going to kill everyone. Right? And that's a very difficult scenario. And unfortunately, I think it comes up in the Tosefta and the sources because it was all too real. And the basic halacha here is that we are, as a community, are not allowed to choose one over the other. Right? So if they say, give us anyone or we're going to kill the whole town, we have to allow the town to be killed, which is shocking, but again goes to this idea that active murder is morally, ethically, halachically problematic, right? Which is exactly the point. So some posts can come along and say, well, based on this principle, how do we choose among the fetuses? How do we choose among the fetuses? So what's the solution to that? So one of the arguments, I'm just going to, I'll go quickly now because of the time, one of the solutions that has been suggested for that is that there may be an exception to the case of the bandits, the case where they surround the city. And it comes up in source 10, but I'll say it outside, which is as follows, and there are other sources as well. Let's say that the people, the bandits, come to the town and they say, either give us one person or we're going to kill all the members of the city, including that person. Including that person. Which is essentially what they're saying in the typical case. Then we might be able to say that what? We have two alternatives. Either way, this person is going to die. Right? Darned if you do, darned if you don't. So we're not killing this individual. That's already been decided by the Gentile marauders. We're just deciding whether to also permit the rest of the town to be killed. So some say the scenario that we're talking about is where they say, either give us that individual or we're going to kill everyone else. But if they say, give this individual or we're going to kill that individual, i.e. plus the town, i.e. everyone, then already we're not doing the killing. Like, what's the purpose? What's the benefit in allowing hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people to be killed unnecessarily? What does that have to do with us? Come back to the case of the fetuses, right? So what's the analogy, right? In this case, the doctors are going, the fetuses are all in danger. There's no possibility that any of them is going to survive anyway. So don't tell me the logic of one's blood is not better than the other one's blood. That's true, but that's in a scenario where they're not both, right? Where they're not all endangered already. Right? Someone is already endangered here. So you might make the argument that no, over here we can choose. How do we choose? Okay, so there we come back to the same medical considerations that we gave earlier, the ones that halacha would view as legitimate. So that's one point that's raised. The other thing that's absolutely fascinating is if you take a look at... let's look at... Yes, take a look at source 6. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a classic tshuva. And again, I'm sorry, I'm doing everything outside because of the time. Rav Moshe says, basically, what's going on in the case of the fetus that has been born? Why, right? Why is it that we're not allowed to choose one over the other? His answer is because in that case, the mother and the fetus are considered to be pursuers of one another. They're considered to be pursuers of one another.
Considered by whom?
Halakha.
Therefore.
And therefore what? Therefore what? Can't choose between them. Some have sought to say, based on Rav Moshe's tshuva, that what? That you wouldn't be able to go ahead and to reduce. Because you have two equally viable fetuses, not full-fledged human beings, but fetuses that are vying against one another. So if the fetuses, again, threaten the mother, it's one scenario. But if the fetuses threaten another, one another, that's a different kind of situation. Which is very interesting. Okay? Which basically leads, I know I'm jumping, but basically it leads to two basic schools of thought among the poskim. One school of thought among the poskim, based on that tshuva of Rav Moshe, basically says that if the fetuses endanger the mother, on that logic we can definitely reduce, but if they only endanger one another, they're considered to be mutual pursuers and we may not choose between them. That's one school of thought. And the other school of thought thinks that no, that if they, even if they're pursuing one another, even if you want to conceptualize it that way, that's fine. So therefore, it's not that therefore they cancel each other out. They're both pursuers. So what should we do?
We can choose
among them. How do we choose among them? The same logic that we would use medically otherwise. There's always going to be one that's easiest to abort. There's always going to be some medical distinction, even if very, very slight and subtle, between them. If you take a look at verses 11 and 12, I gave you sort of representatives of these two. One is Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, a prominent halachic, contemporary halachic authority, approaches the question in a rather original way. First suggests that if the pregnancy is not a threat to the mother, then aborting some of the fetuses might not be permitted due to the concerns of choosing one life over another, right? So what we just said may be based on Rav Moshe. I'm not saying Rav Moshe said it. Rav Moshe died before fetal reduction was a live issue. He died in 1986. He didn't address the issue directly, but based as a plausible extension of his logic, not necessarily, but maybe. Zilberstein then proposes two approaches that would suggest that multi-fetal reduction might be permissible, even if only to save the lives of some of the fetuses. Zilberstein brings an analogy to a case in the Talmud, where a group of people were attacked and asked to turn over one member of the group to be chosen by the group for execution, or all will be killed. While most halakha experts rule that all must die, said earlier, rather than choosing an innocent party to be killed, Rabbi Zilberstein points out that there are authorities who restrict the prohibition of choosing someone to cases where the chosen victim could theoretically escape. That's what we said earlier, right? Same thing. But if it was clear that all would die if one were not turned over, then some authorities allow an innocent person to be chosen by lottery, which is a very interesting addition, and sacrifice to save the others in the group. If this conclusion applies to already born people with full human status, then certainly it should apply to fetuses who do not yet have status of being viable. That is, so long as the fetuses are in utero, they do not necessarily fall into the prohibition of not choosing one life over another. Therefore, multi-fetal reduction should be permitted as an act of life-saving fetal protection and not as an act of fetal destruction. Okay, so Rabbi Zilberstein, who's a prominent medical ethics posek, he's the posek for Machon Pua, for the Pua Institute, the Institute of Fertility in Israel. His initial thought is we can only kill the fetuses, abort the fetuses to save the life of the mother, but his conclusion is that actually, even when they threaten one another, there could be a legitimate argument to say, well, it's just like the townspeople, if the person's going to die anyway, then it would be permitted. Rabbi Zilberstein also compares pregnancy reduction to using a tractor. Sorry about this. I know it's a... I'm sure he said so with great sensitivity, but it kind of comes off, a little bit unusually in this presentation, to using a tractor to save people trapped in the rubble of a collapsed building. If all will die if nothing is done, then he argues that some scholars would permit the use of a tractor to plow through the rubble. Even if some of the doomed people are killed sooner by the tractor, many people may be saved who would have died. It's interesting. Similarly, since all the fetuses will likely die, argues that it is permissible to kill a few prematurely to save the rest. This is just a variation on the previous argument, right? He's saying, if you have people stuck under rubble, and the only way, basically they're all going to die unless you pull the tractor through, so they're already condemned to death anyway. It's just like the Gentiles who come and say, we're going to kill everyone in the city. It's the same argument. He says it would be the same thing. Then, one other opinion, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, who around the time of the founding of the State of Israel was a very prominent halachic authority, he writes a four-volume response called Aseh Lecha Rav, right? Make for yourself a rabbi, right? And he says, and if you'd like me to be yours, I'm happy to supply. Okay? It's the implication. Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, in the same compilation of halachic articles, again, it's just a quotation from an article summarizing the issues, I think it's from Dr. Eisenberg, takes a more linear approach. He contends that there is a spectrum of opinions regarding abortion, right, what we said earlier, from very restrictive to allowing abortion for T-sex up to 7 months, right? So basically, Rav Moshe is on one end of the spectrum, Rav Moshe Weinstein, and mentioned last time that Tzitzili Ezra and Waldenberg on the opposite side, at least in one of his responsa, and that most authorities agree that aborting a non-viable fetus is not murder, right? If it's prior to 22 weeks or whatever the age of viability is, at this point, it's not murder. He argues that multi-fetal reduction is permissible, if by not performing the reduction, the fetuses will be born prematurely and with severe mental or physical defects. He allows reducing to the point necessary to allow the remaining fetuses to be born healthy. Well, that's even a further point along the spectrum. So to summarize the halakhic opinions, they are not only about 2, 3, 4, right? Because obviously it's not about 2, 3, 4 only, because there are a myriad of medical considerations. You can't just give a calculus. Every case is different. So it's not so much just about 2, 3, 4, although yes, it's true that as a general matter, in case of 2, most poskim will certainly say it's aser, unless there are complicating factors. Even 3, most will say it's aser. That's where secular medical ethics might be different. In case of 4, there would generally be unanimity. all things being equal medically, but it's more than that. There's sort of this larger issue of what's the underlying logic. And here we have three plausible positions that we have identified among the poskim. One position, which might or might not be a stringent application of Moshe Feinstein, might be to say that only if they're threatening the life of the mother, but if they're only threatening one another, then what we need to say is we have to throw up our hands, we can't choose among them, and what we'd have to say, that's not legitimate grounds for abortion. Emily doesn't find that convincing, but that's a plausible view, okay? You were being subtle about it, so it's just a wild guess based on your facial expression. A second possibility is what... Don't worry, Rabbi Zilberstein is with you. It's certainly kind of a levy. The second position we identified is that, right, this Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein from Machon Pua says that no, that even if they're threatening one another, because after all, it'll be comparable to the case where that person's going to die anyway. We're not choosing to kill the fetus. All the fetuses are in danger. It might be comparable to that. Of course, you can question that because in the case of the bandits, someone's going to die from the Jewish town, but not all the fetuses are necessarily going to die. Yeah, so it's not so simple. That might be the response. It's not so simple. But we can question that logic, but that's his psa. And Ruchaim David Alevi, who goes even further and says, well, maybe even if it's not threatening the life of the fetuses, but even if it threatens the well-being of the fetuses, that might even be a legitimate basis for leniency. And these are really the most important positions, because it's not just about 2, 3, 4, it's really about what is the halachic logic, because then you would take that and apply it in every scenario. Now again, as you say, how this works out in real life for real doctors who have real medical responsibilities and patient autonomy and medical associations and hospital and so on and so forth is not a simple matter. So this is just sort of pristine halacha. And I don't mean to say it doesn't actually work itself out in a very complex way in the real world. It surely does. But I do think that this is an accurate and helpful conceptual framework for how halacha would think about these types of questions. Mm-hmm. So we are over time, but that is it for today.